Welcome to Counter Stories, a conversation by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Don Eubanks, assistant professor and cultural consultant at Metropolitan State University.
Anthony Galloway, equity consultant in Black Male.
Luz Maria Frias, president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis. And I did have more of the authentic pronunciation today because I heard from a young man who's a blurred, by the way. And he challenged me as to why I wasn't being authentic with my pronunciation. So shout out to him on that one.
Hilly Lee isn't with us this evening. So tonight we have a guest with us, Marianne Quiros. And so I'll have Marianne introduce herself. And we also have been starting something new and different with Counter Stories. And so this evening we have another representative, Minnesota Public Radio News, Jonathan Blakely. So
welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, nice to be here. My name is Marianne Quiros. Good job pronouncing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm the co-director and cultural arts director for Indigenous Roots.
I am Jonathan Blakely, and I am the program director here at Minnesota Public Radio News.
Welcome, welcome, Brother Blakely.
Been here about 3.5 years, not that long, but long enough to know what's kind of going on around here.
Now, I'm going to tell my Marianne story because everybody's got one, but this is mine. This is how I first met Marianne Quiros. I was called by Ayana Sola Machado, who was here with us earlier talking about some of the work in getting airdrops to Puerto Rico. And so she calls me one time and she says, hey, there's a group of kids are trying to go to Standing Rock. And I said, awesome. And she was like, they could use some extra adults to come and help to do it. I was like, all right, cool. And I got to be part of a group that Marianne led that took Native students to Standing Rock to participate and help and support the camps there. So Marianne does a great work in the community.
Thank you. We rolled in deep. 148. Yeah, we rolled in deep. That was good.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So, can you tell us more about Indigenous Roots? I'm sorry, just because I shared that story and I want to talk about.
It's definitely a blossoming organization, and I think it's much more than an organization. It definitely is building community power on the east side and beyond. There's five cultural dance groups that's housed out of there currently. So it's Kalpuli Yausenoshli, which is a Mexica Aztec dance group that my husband Sergio Quiros and I lead. Bomba Carayague with Ayana Sol Machado. We work with Travis DeCori of Ayanda Young, and he does Native youth dance clinics there monthly. Minnesota Haitian Cultural Center is also housed out of there with Anna Dabra, and also Cypherside with Lou Tao, national breakdance champion, is definitely, he got tired, I think, of going all the way to Coon Rapids and Hopkins for a dance studio. And he's like, come on, we should have one here so we don't have to keep bringing our East Side kids out of the hood. So, yeah, that's us. Check us out. We're up the street from Metro State University on 7th Street on the east side of St. Paul.
Anthony, what is your Jonathan Blakely story?
I have a Jonathan Blakely story.
It was part of going to see Black Panther.
Well, yeah.
Even though we met much before that, but that's the first movie that comes to mind.
So along that note, I think that often when we get together for Counter Stories, we usually bounce around a lot of ideas in order to come up with talking points. And I think that Jonathan, you raised, I think, an interesting area for us to explore. And I was wondering if you might want to share a little bit about what happened yesterday in the governor's address.
Yeah, so the governor gave his annual State of the State, Governor Dayton, which is his last State of the State after 8 years. We're going to have a new governor this year. And so typical State of the State address, talking about little of this and little of that, and there was some clapping on one side of the aisle, and then folks on the other side of the aisle clapping. Okay, that's cool. So, you know, I'm listening, you know, waiting for the something that to really grab my ear. And, you know, not that it was a bad State of the State, but okay. Maybe it was a little nostalgic because it's Governor Dayton's last one. But as he got towards the end, he started speaking about something I wasn't prepared to hear. And actually, quite frankly, if you don't mind, I'll read from him because I just didn't think that he was going to go there. And I'd love to hear what you guys are thinking about where he went with his State of the State. And this is a State of the State, again, delivered in the year 2018. So this is Governor Dayton. USA Today said we're the nation's best run state. AARP ranked us as the very best state in which to retire. And CNBC says we're the third best state for business. We're not perfect, but compared to everyone else, we're very good. Okay. I say again that the credit belongs to the people of Minnesota. We are our people, but we're only as good as all of us are. That means all of us in a state with rapidly changing demographics, in which 19% of our residents are now women, men, and children of color. He goes on to say, that is a very different complexion from years ago, and some folks still resist the change. If we can educate them to move beyond racism, religious bigotry, and other hatreds, they will see that this new diversity is crucial to our state's future success. And it just struck me that it's 2018 and a governor said, I need to say this. But I'm also glad that the governor said this. He could have totally ignored the elephant in the room and it would have been a fine State of the State. But he went there. Did he need to go there? Should he have gone further?
You know, I didn't catch the speech itself, just tidbits on coverage since the speech was delivered. And what I immediately thought of when I heard you, Jonathan, speak about that is the fact that the governor is the first governor, to my knowledge, that has an office and an officer in, by the title of Chief Inclusion Officer, James Burroughs. And that to me and to many of our POCI communities is an indicator of the commitment that the governor has had on the issue of diversity and inclusion. And in fact, one of his biggest legacies, I mean, I think last night he mentioned his legacy being balancing the budget and having a surplus rather than a deficit. I would venture to argue that legacy might be superseded by the fact that he has made the most appointments of people of color, indigenous people, GLPTQ judges in the history of the state. And it shouldn't be that historic, but it is in this day and age. And that really speaks to, again, his commitment, intentionality, and those who serve on the Judicial Commission to be able to get to that point. But it takes someone in that leadership role to effectuate systemic change.
It starts at the top.
Right. It starts at the top, and it has to be intentional. And people have to move outside of their comfort zone and be supportive of it. And that doesn't always happen. I myself am happy and quite honestly proud that he went there.
Yeah.
I just didn't see it coming. Like, whoa, okay.
I actually met James Burroughs today, so I'm glad you brought that up. I was at the state capitol all day today with the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. It was their at Capitol Day, and he actually talked about exactly what you had just mentioned, Luce, about when Governor Dayton started, the diversity of the employees was at 8%, and their goal was to get it up to 20%. And I think today he reported it's at 11 to 12%. So they have goals for this year, you know, to for that transition. And as far as, you know, Governor Dayton, I think bringing that up, I mean, it's his last speech. No one's really going to criticize him.
So also was the end of his speech.
Yeah. And yes. End is the end of the end of the end. And so
the last paragraph is like, goodbye. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's a safe thing, right? Like it's that Midwest thing to be like, okay, I'm heading out. But before I drop the mic, hey, you guys still have all this work to do. So,
yeah. And it's not surprising. He's on his way out, and it's the end of the end before they feel confident enough to admit.
Coined by Marianne. The end of the end.
to admit these kind of things. And because I too missed the governor's speech, hearing what he said, my immediate reaction is at least he's acknowledging the fact that when these reports come out, it's real clear that when Minnesota's ranked in these different categories, it's based on the success of what our white counterparts in the state of Minnesota get to enjoy. While the disparities for communities of color and for the American Indians, and we don't usually show up in those reports because our numbers are so low, but the disparities are so wide in terms of all the things that the rest of Minnesotans get to enjoy here. So, you know, it's encouraging to hear him actually acknowledge that, even though he didn't point it out specifically. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that that's what he was referencing.
I don't know. For me, it kind of seems like, you know, I'm glad folks are excited that this happened. And I was driving in my car and I was like, okay, he's going to go there. But, you know, it's Governor Dayton. You know, there's a transition period where this became something that, okay, that's something that he would do. So I don't know if I feel as big of a kind of, you know, sea change, you know, for the end of it, as I've heard some folks throughout the day talk about. Some folks see this as a marking, defining moment in Minnesota's history. And a lot of us folks of color that were on the same table were like, eh.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to the National Geographic article that's out right now for me. Mm-hmm. Like, National Geographic's doing this work to uncover or to address all these things that in community. I heard that when I was little about how racist National Geographic was. That was just a conversation in community. But now we're supposed to pat on the back or you know, be real, you know, do a backflip because somebody's finally addressing it. It's kind of like, well, we're so great. You're finally treating me like a human. Mm. We still got a whole lot of ways to go. We're not done yet.
The proof really will be what's next, you know, in terms of action steps and commitments with intentionality. One example I would offer is when I was working for the mayor of St. Paul, Chris Coleman at the time, we designed what was known as the EMS Academy to infuse women into the firefighter position, but also communities of color and indigenous community in that. And then 4 years later after that, we introduced that in Minneapolis. And if you compare the two initiatives, the Minneapolis Fire Department is far and wide, much more advanced and committed. And in fact, in year two, by the end of year two, 17 of our graduates would be now firefighters in just a couple months, three of whom are women, and women of two of whom of those three women are women of color. By comparison, in St. Paul, we're not even at a fraction of that. And what it goes to is the commitment at the top. Mayor Chris Coleman had the commitment, but he, I would say, had to address different factions within the fire department and the leader at that time, which is a different leader than it is now. But it matters that who's at the top making that commitment, and the fire chief in Minneapolis is right on that, and he's got a commitment. He's showing that to us. And ultimately speaking, these positions in life, whether they're in the public service or in the private service, should be reflective of our community. And that's we're just looking for representation and equity and inclusion, and we need a commitment for that.
Let me read his second to last paragraph, because the last paragraph was thank you very much, and he dropped the mic. But before that, he said, adjusting to this new reality is hard for some Minnesotans. But trying to push back Minnesota 50 years is neither a realistic option nor a good idea. He says, I want to be very clear. Minnesota is an inclusive and welcoming place for all. And we all stand together in making that statement to everybody in Minnesota. Hmm. Discuss.
I think that last statement about being welcoming and things like that, it's funny that I'm actually sitting here with you guys. My family and I immigrated from the Philippines exactly 29 years to this date. Wow. So March 15, 1989.
Wow.
And we came directly to St. Paul, and we lived with my auntie for a little bit because we didn't know where to live. And it was literally like we came at the airport, and it was that moment in Coming to America where it was like a blizzard, and then he
they didn't want to go outside.
Didn't want to go outside because they saw, and it was like that. We were not prepared for the blizzard of March, and I had on like a mini jean skirt and some sandals, and so we had to wait till we were picked up. But we were welcomed, but we were welcomed by our family. Right. So it was a community that was already waiting for us, our extended family. And we didn't hit the culture shock really until we started in the schools, until I started school. And even though I didn't know the language and I didn't know kind of the ins and outs of things, tone is, you know, you can't change that tone. And facial expressions and nonverbal cues. Those you can pick up without knowing the English language. So for me, anyways, going back to what he's Governor Dayton had stated, you know, I think it's welcoming for folks who already have extended roots here in this space, but for the most part, it really isn't still. And with National Geographic, I think they finally had enough staff and enough readers where they're like, hey, let's publicly address this and make it a cover. And
Is it taking advantage of the Me Too movement to go there?
Like, not for me. Folks are growing more to step out in this reign more boldly now, because the pushback that they'll get from folks who are made uncomfortable by it, there's now the opportunity of seeing that that doesn't have to be the mentality all the time. So I don't think that the National Geographic did all that risky a thing in doing so.
Exactly.
So there didn't seem like there was a whole lot of risk to that decision.
Yeah. And for me, there, I find value. And again, I'm the incurable optimist in the group. So for me, I do find value and importance that they came out publicly with that observation. Like you said, Anthony, I think that was a well-known observation in communities of color and indigenous communities. Yeah. And I remember with clarity as I read the article a day or two ago, thinking back on all the National Geographic pictures and magazines that I read as a child. And my observation back then, even, you know, I'm in grade school and as young as third grade, thinking, why do people look like that? They can't look like that right now. And it was this objectifying of a very antiquated stereotype of who people of color were around the world. And
even,
thinking,
even I was
no
indoctrinated
way.
With it in college. I went to
sitting in the dentist office
in college. I remember going, we were going to South Africa, and we got down in the plane, and in my mind, like, I hadn't even thought about the fact about the step off, these little plane steps into this, you know, rustic thing. And I get off the plane to get to the airport, and I just remember there being a moment of going, man, this looks like Chicago, and having a feeling like it shouldn't. And then I had to stop, and it was, and you go back to the National Geographic pictures. So even me, because I'm sure at that point there was modern pictures of what actually places look like. But even I had that mentality, having a more modern set when they supposedly stopped doing as much of that.
But Anthony, even if there were modern pictures, most of us weren't exposed to them. Because I don't remember seeing them on media, and they weren't being portrayed on TV, and they weren't being portrayed anywhere else.
And I would offer also that continues today. Beyond National Geographic, right? Mm-hmm. That the portrayal of people living in Africa all seem to be of a certain type, which is starvation and deprivation and still wearing tribal clothing. Some folks may wear tribal clothing, but that's not the only thing that they wear, you know. And
downtown Johannesburg looked like Chicago, and Cape Town looked just like Miami.
I hear you.
If you want to see one of the best airports in the world, go to Johannesburg.
But so we that stereotype continues to be perpetuated by the larger media, in addition to National Geographic, would be my point.
So for example. The coverage of the Parkland shooters. You know, this is one of the things that comes up for me in our anti-racist student leadership groups. These are some of the groups that I was talking to you about when we took students to Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. They have been organizing and doing a lot of work all over the place. And it's published even in the social media category, because I've seen videos of kids giving awesome speeches and things like that. Mm-hmm. But somehow Everybody's registering in all these different groups. The fact that the Parkland shooting students are getting more airtime, more play, kind of more interest story than the kids who've been doing very similar demonstrations and walkouts for years, and very eloquently, but they're not talked about.
Mm-hmm. They're getting more coverage. They're being treated as celebrity. And to be clear, we all agree that the work that they're doing has a lot of value. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it's necessary.
It's a sea change.
And that we support it. The dichotomy here, though, is how that movement is being viewed and treated by not only media, but quite honestly, leaders as well, and being elevated and celebrated versus being demonized when our youth who are working against the brutality against unarmed black and brown people. And I would say, and within a couple of days, the $3 million that came in from celebrities for the Parkland movement to then have a march, at the Capitol, and that really didn't materialize for the youth protesting for the movement for Black Lives, and the treatment, the humanitarian treatment that is being extended to the Parkland protesters nationally versus how, again, the youth in the movement for Black Lives, where you had, militarization of police, they had the mace being sprayed in children as young as 10 years old here in Minneapolis. Let's not forget that. And the riot gear and things of that sort. And the question we would ask is why? And it's a rhetorical question, but, we should ask that. We know we have seen on social media a backlash in terms of this narrative with communities of color and indigenous community raising that disparate treatment of our youth. And it's my understanding, at least from reading and looking at these articles, that some of those Parkland shooter organizers are now reaching out mm-hmm. to communities of color and indigenous community. The youth saying, we now understand your pain. Didn't see it initially, mm-hmm. but we want to work with mm-hmm. you and include you on that. And I think folks are nodding their heads.
Well, you want to capitalize on that, but it still gives you and you have to just swallow the bitter pill of, dang, that sucks. But hey, we've got momentum. Let's roll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens when, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand kids mm-hmm. show up on the National Mall in Washington. What is that going to mean? I don't know. What does it mean when a million people showed up in 96?
To the Million Man March.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the power of that convening and this gets me back to thinking about in terms of indigenous roots, the power that comes with how are we get here? Now I've got an identity. I've got something that's being seen, and that's something I can rally around and celebrate for I don't know, kind of a new normal on who we are. Mm-hmm. This is going to set the language that we use to talk about this type of movement, when we come back and look back at this, just mm-hmm. like Rodney King changed the conversation, just like all these other touch points, Kate, changed mm-hmm. conversation. We're going to have new language from these students and a new normal about who we are. And we have to do that collectively. And it made me think about just even the name Indigenous Roots. How did those get formed?
Not
the organization, although that's important too.
Well, the name itself, definitely, it was, there isn't any fancy, dreamy story. It was literally my husband and I, we were driving to Chicago for ceremony, and we're like, okay, all of the things that we've done, it kind of just organically happened. It wasn't like, okay, it's 2015, let's start our organization, mm-hmm. and none of those things. It just came out of community need. And not just like ours or anyone else. It was like this collective need that we all just really craved and were looking for. So, and for the roots part, we all have roots. It doesn't matter where you came from, what time and space, we all are rooted someplace, somewhere. And it depends how deep those roots are. And some of us, and I can only speak for myself as somebody, a Filipino immigrant, I had to assimilate a lot. I lost a lot of words in my language, but I'm grateful to have, elders in the community that still speak the language so that it doesn't die out or become extinct. So it's interesting you brought up the youth. I always feel like everything I've done has always been like youth led. So Standing Rock, even though folks are like, oh, you led it, it wasn't actually me. Like, they saw photos of me go to Standing Rock Labor Day weekend that year, and they were like, you went to Standing Rock and you didn't tell us about it? I was like, yeah. I was like, do you want to go? They're like, yes. And so it went from like 5 youth to 10 youth, and then it just kept multiplying. And the fact that we were able to bring out of the 148, you know, over 90 of them were youth. I mean, there was only a handful of adults with us.
Yeah.
And they were mostly Native youth or youth of color. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really powerful moment. So that is definitely the same way how Indigenous Roots came about, is just our focus is to really create space and time and opportunities for us to provide culturally relevant whatever that is for that person, for that community to express themselves and to get reconnected. If not, if they're already connected, then maintaining it.
Like the kind of world or vision for the state that Governor Dayton was talking about, right? This is who we look like. This is what it is.
He must have read our website. Yeah. Initial statement. I'm just kidding, Governor Dayton.
You know, I was sitting here reflecting on Governor Dayton's words in his speech. And then, you know, this morning I was listening to NPR, and I happened to just catch the tail end of a report that was kind of talking a little bit about the bill, I believe the Senate passed, lifting restrictions, certain restrictions on banks.
Oh, you mean
from in the, Congress.
Yeah, in Congress.
In Congress. Yeah. Loosening those restrictions for banks with, I don't know, portfolios less than $250 billion. But in this report, they just casually mentioned that also one of the other things that is being lifted is those banks that will be impacted by this also no longer have to collect or report data, racial data, on who they provide housing and other types of loans to. And it was just casually mentioned.
Oh, geez.
Well, for me, I was like, are you kidding me? It's like for every positive or what we could perceive as a positive movement in the right direction in terms of the desperate impact many of our communities of color and American Indians have felt in this country, then I hear a report like that that's taken us back. And so it's like every day I feel I can go from being elated to being dejected within a minute as a person of color and as a Native American. Just day to day, I feel like I'm being assaulted.
Mm. Yeah, I believe you're talking about some of the Dodd-Frank rollbacks.
And that's right.
Yeah, you don't hear about. You're talking about the devil in details.
Exactly.
And those details affect a whole lot of folks.
It's like we've been under assault for the past week, because while all the distractions are going on with the president's tweets, in the meantime, he's signing executive orders here, or his secretaries of all these different positions, they're kind of slowly dismantling all these safety nets that were put in place across the board. They are slowly dismantling all these things in every area.
And that were put across the board after decades of fighting for
right,
them.
There was a reason why they were
right?
there.
Exactly.
And decades of fighting, and the civil rights movement in the 60s, where people lost their lives to have these measures put in place. I hadn't heard that, Don.
Well, I mean, it's just the Senate now. I think it still has some.
Right. It still has to go through the House. Yeah. But still, do you think the House is going to put that back in?
I'm not going to change. I'm not going to bet any money on that one.
Exactly.
The $280 billion I got in the bank. I'm
kidding. Exactly. But it's those little minute details I had never heard. And that just, you know, I just heard that this morning. I went, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. You know, just the loosening of that requirement, because we've been trying to recover in the disparities in terms of housing. And by removing those requirements across the board and HUD requirements and all these other requirements, it's any efforts that we have tried to gain in terms of equity in those areas are being pushed back against the curb.
Well, and just to connect the dots on this, a little bit deeper, and Don, you've positioned it well, is we know that the transfer of wealth is largely attributed to and tied to home ownership. So if our
communities, at least before 07.
If our communities of color and indigenous people don't have the opportunity to own a house, then that generational cycle of poverty perpetuates because we don't have that transfer of wealth to be able to occur. And then it also goes into, you know, a whole lot of other things in terms of having access to credit and having the ability to have stability in your life and not worry about losing housing and, and being highly mobile, not of your own accord, but because the system is designed that way, and having rents that you can't afford. And you've got multiple families living homes in order to try to address that and try to meet their monthly expenses.
Yeah. I mean, housing ties in all that, which is why 07, 08 was so devastating. But you have the house, and then you're paying the taxes, and that means the school stays open, and you're the school, and they can afford toilet paper and the basics in schools. And once that part goes away, it's just a spiral. And it, look, here it is 10 years later, and I wouldn't say that we've completely recovered. You can drive through one of the top 10, 20 cities, and you're going to see homes that are either have been foreclosed or are being foreclosed today. We're still in a bad situation.
And that's the disparity that Governor Dayton's alluding to, you know. So you know, I'm growing on, I'm being more affected by the fact that he said this, just in thinking about all of these gaps that loom across all of these different places, and there is no conversation outright about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, across multiple sectors. So you mentioned housing disparity. We've mentioned school disparity. We've mentioned the disparity in job attainment. I mean, you can keep adding to this list.
Income.
And so, you know, folks fail to connect that to one of the earlier things he said about us maintaining and staying competitive. These are the folks who, and you talked about folks from outside of Minnesota, and that one stumped me a little bit, because I'm like, you got folks in Minnesota who would benefit from the jobs that will need to be filled, and we don't have the people, right? And the people he's talking about are the people who are at the bottom of these gaps. And so I'm hoping that people put those connections together.
It's also interesting that he said 50, he used 50, which, you know, that takes us back to the 60s.
Well, I mean, I thought that was intentional.
Yeah, right. I mean, the civil rights movement, right?
Yeah.
And we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination in a couple of weeks.
But are we... How do you, it still strikes me that we have the leader of a fairly, at least one to be progressive state that has to say, hey, guys, open your eyes. Basically, that's what he said, you know, and it's 2008. This is not 2000. It's not 1918. It's 2018.
We're not as progressive as I perceived us back in the 60s and 70s. That's for sure, considering that Trump carried everything outside of major metropolitan area in the state of Minnesota. But, you know, in that regard, I mean, because we're talking about, you know, those desperate disparities that impact us across the board. But even, you know, even for, because I think Minnesota has done a very good job attempting to do a job similar to what Dayton's doing with his administration by increasing the amount of diversity. It would be different if the individuals that they recruit and other companies, I think, are also doing, and we've talked about this in a previous podcast, where other companies are doing, are reaching out and doing a good job in recruiting of from communities of color and American Indian community. But when it comes to retention, not as well.
Yeah.
Because after they successfully recruit individuals to the state of Minnesota, they don't end up staying.
Because? And,
there's a whole set of reasons.
I mean, that's a whole nother, that's a whole nother conversation. But, you know, even because you know, as we're having this conversation and we're talking about these gaps, and we're talking about the voices of the youth from Parkland and how our youth aren't heard. And, you know, something as simple as just trying to get a football team to change the racist name of their team, the Washington Redskins, and how derogatory that name is in terms of for Native Americans. And we're still drowned out by the dominant culture just in a simple request of having a simple name change, just to show that disparity. And I wonder if, you know, the Parkland students were to take up that manner, how if it would impact. And I understand exactly what you're saying, you know, in terms of, you know, when we strategize. But, you know, why is it that in this country we need to have to do that? And that's what just bugs me.
Your comment is not 2019. It's not in 1918. Or 1818.
Yeah. Exactly.
2019.
I hope it's not 1918.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, there's an element of this that comes to mind as well in terms of well-meaning Minnesotans who understand the need to change, who see the disparities. And I often say we have become the land of 10,000 disparities because everywhere you look, there's a disparity of some sort, but don't know how. Generally speaking, they're overwhelmed by the complexity of the depth of the disparities and not knowing how to begin to address it. And we, I think, I'll say this for YWCA Minneapolis, we have a program that empowers people to do that on an individual level, institutional level, and systemic level. But we're just one organization, and we don't have, you know, the bandwidth to do this statewide, but we are actively in this space, and the groups that we are able to connect with in the private sector as employers, in government, with county and state leaders, we are seeing changes. So again, my incurable optimist comes out to say it is possible. We just need the intentionality, and we need the leaders to begin to connect the dots for themselves and see the paths. And when you don't see the paths, then ask community to lead. You know, ask the community to lead to the solutions.
Yes.
So can I ask a question? Because I was tied up in staff meeting all today, and so I haven't had a chance to check social media, and I haven't heard the radio. But there was an interesting election in
Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania. And I know last night or early this morning when I last heard about that, it appeared the Democrat had a slight lead over the Republican candidate.
Yeah, they declared him the winner.
They did declare him a winner.
Yes. There may be a challenge, but they've declared him the winner. Yeah.
Okay. So
in this is in a district, a gerrymandered district, by the way. I was gerrymandered to be very pro-Republican. This is a district that just a year ago went 20 points for Trump. So now, by a hair, a Democrat won in that district for this congressional seat. By a hair.
It's a good long hair.
It's a hair. Long enough. I mean, it's a nice size hair. But still, I mean, again, Trump blasted or just totally won that.
By like 20 points. 20
yeah,
points,
like crazy.
Correct?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I guess I was just bringing that up as do we see that as a ray of hope, a light at the end of the tunnel? I guess I was just bringing it up for conversation piece, but for me, it was slightly encouraging because I know also the Democrat won in Alabama during that special election. And it seems
or a
like,
Democrat in Alabama is already
exactly, which is, you know, and so, because I guess I was bringing this up because I know that we generally have this discussions. And when I look at the environment and I look at the state of Minnesota, and it still amazes me that after all these years, we are still 81% white in Minnesota. Native Americans, I know we only make up about 1 point, depending on that stat, somewhere between 1.2-1.8% of the population. So we're almost 70,000 strong now. And so, you know, the question often that kind of bubbles up in my mind is, what would take for our white colleagues to really make that change that the governor was asking for?
I think that's a huge ask. I mean, I wouldn't even put that expectation for me. And it's a good question, and I actually ask that same question, but I also get tired of being asked to come and speak to groups or meetings of predominantly white people to talk about my culture or my cultural background and this and that.
And so, let me touch your hair.
Yes. Actually, yeah. Scary enough, my gymnastics coach, like back in the day, she was like this really like suburban white lady. And she's like, I love the smell of your hair. I didn't know how creepy it was until I was like older. But she's like, it smells like Filipino food. I'm like,
okay.
What? Yeah, it was like crazy. But that's the stuff I grew up with. But
kid
so pitting. I'm glad you brought that up because that was the same thing that working at St. Paul Public School District for like 10 years, like that was like my mission. Like if they just get it, if these parents just got it or the staff just got it, like the achievement gap would like magically go away or whatever. And the bottom line is no. And I think that's why we as community leaders in our communities, in our own communities, need to organize and mobilize and really bring folks together and do a lot of building nations with one another, because I was really hopeful to see like the city council in Minneapolis like have a huge turnover. You know, us having our city of St. Paul mayor is Mayor Melvin Carter. I mean, like that's like the hopes and dreams, right? So I think instead of like me having to be like, what is it going to take? I just feel like I think within this, like even just the power in this room and space right now, I think is already making those changes. And the youth that I see in a regular basis, I mean, watch out. I mean, they're youth now and they're outspoken and they're ready and they're so grounded. And so for us, I don't know. They don't want to talk to white people too about how they're going to convince them to change. They are leading it.
Yeah, it starts at the top, but it starts at the top unless there's a huge groundswell at, I don't say the bottom, but mm-hmm. below, from below.
Yes.
And I think there is a groundswell. There's several groundswells going on. One of it's manifested in Black Lives Matter. One of it's manifested in Me Too. And there seems to be something going on with the youth that was probably already going on, just like Black Lives Matter was already going on. You know, you could argue that folks were getting tired of being harassed in office buildings. That didn't start yesterday. No. Folks are sick of that forever. You know, but there's a big groundswell right now with the help of the fact that we're in a different media. 50 years ago, we didn't have Twitter.
Right.
You know.
Don, when I think about your question, I think my response that comes to mind is all hands on deck. Because of the monumental size of the problem, that it has to be at every possible entry point and every lever possible to be able to effectuate change within the near future. It took generations to get to this hot mess that we have in Minnesota. It won't happen overnight to rectify the situation, but if we have an all-hands-on-deck approach, and going back to Anthony's point, economically, our state can't afford to do anything other than that because if you just look at the demographics of our youth under 18, the youth in kindergarten, that's our future. And big numbers, not in isolated numbers, not in only certain counties. So it has to change in order for our businesses to be able to be sustainable. You can import people from other states, but the retention issue is still an issue, as Don pointed to earlier. Fundamentally, there has to be a sea change.
But, of course, that sea change has to come from folks who are on the job. So yeah, great things start at the top. But this is, to your point, Marianne, this is somebody going, see ya, last year. Don't have to deal with any of the aftermath that comes after unless I actively, proactively get involved. So that sea change has to be the whole sea and folks who are going to be in the water.
Well, then I would say we can also interpret the governor's statement to be a baton to the citizenry of the state to say, Now use this as your platform as you're selecting the new governor.
That's fair.
Use this as your platform when you're selecting the new legislature, that the House is all up on the ballot in Minnesota this year. Use this as your filter as you're selecting your leaders at the local level. We can certainly interpret that and leverage that as a baton, as a challenge to us as a democracy to continue that legacy.
Well, and I have to be, but I have to be honest to share this, because the presidential election, in my mind, some of the issues that propelled this individual into his presidency were against the very things that we're talking about. And so a part of me wants to remain optimistic that we have been pushing and striving and moving in such a positive direction when it came to understanding from our white counterparts in terms of the inequities, the social injustices that have been thrust upon communities of color and American Indians. And in one election, it kind of wiped that all out. And so I, too, want to remain optimistic that we are moving in that positive manner, which is why even an election in Pennsylvania still, for me, remains that little ray of hope. You know, for me, that I can hold on to, that still encourages me to want to get up the next morning. I mean, so, and it's not that I'm ready to throw in the towel, but, you know, the reason why I brought up the little episode from the report I heard on NPR this morning is because you're feeling positive about this election result, and then I hear that in this little tiny bill, they remove that requirement for reporting racial data, which is going to take us back again. So every time I feel like we're moving forward, something reminds me that, it, or there's something that's tethered to it that just kind of keeps us hovering in the same spot.
But I think, again, the you look at Alabama, and that was a, not just a Democrat won the Senate seat in Alabama, but a civil rights lawyer. I mean, wow. Like, folks are re-spinning in their graves.
Not a civil rights lawyer.
The civil rights lawyer. Yeah, the, yeah.
And
you know, what I saw with this election in Pennsylvania was, no matter how you feel politically, every vote counts. So that whole sorry thing about my vote doesn't matter, it sure does.
It sure does.
I mean, 100%. If you don't vote, you really don't have any, you don't have anything to say.
And I think the other thing, when if you look deeper, and I'm going by what I've been hearing on reports, but in Alabama, it was the black vote that carried this candidate.
The black female vote. Female.
Black female vote.
Yep.
And in Pennsylvania, it was labor.
Yeah, from that side of the state. Yeah.
From
my
understanding.
Yes.
And I only bring that up because historically, it has been those groups and also low-income white folks that this country has been successful in keeping us separated. And to me, these
so
are
more
just,
like divide and conquer.
Exactly. And to me, this highlights the fact that we share more in common than we do in differences if we allow ourselves to put aside race, to put aside those ethnic differences. And so I was just pointing that out
not
to
show. Not to be conflated with put away racism.
Exactly, like, which is
acknowledge
I can get over,
it.
Can get over race.
No, but acknowledge,
exactly.
Acknowledge what's going on.
Dismantle racism. Exactly. Thank you for.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so that's why I was feeling encouraged.
Well, and, it also goes to your point, Don, when historically speaking, in the political sphere, political leaders have easily position communities of color, indigenous people to work against each other, divide and conquer, and fighting for that sliver of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
When we know as equity leaders, the fight is for the full pie.
Mm-hmm.
And so those days of give us a slice of the pie are long gone. And the days of our we want access to the full pie. Okay. And that, I think, is just that seismic shift that needs to happen, that as these movements are starting to really take hold and work across our communities of color and indigenous community, that's really where the change is going to happen.
And speaking of pie, because it was Pride Day yesterday. And I love what you said. And it's like, actually, we're growing the ingredients. Change is inevitable. I mean, it's going to happen. And my favorite thing my mom always tells me is nothing's forever. Nothing is permanent. So what is happening right now, the chaos and all of these things that's happening in our administration, he's dismantling everything that was happening the first 8 years in the Obama administration. He's not going to be there. It's going to change. I think this is also pushing a lot of us, at least the people that the circles I'm with, is, you know, when things that he's taking off, bills against energy efficient and environmental things. Great. What can we do? Let's harness our own ancestral knowledge and bring that back into our communities. If it's about education, like the education is going to be a mess, fine. Homeschool collectives, we start our own places of learning, you know. And so I think there's always, as humans, we always come up with creative solutions if we're pinned against, especially indigenous folks and folks of color. We're so resilient. We're not going to give up because we know who we're fighting this for. And so, yeah, that's all I got to change about that. Change is inevitable. So it's all good.
I think that's what Governor Dayton is trying to get at.
I think so.
Change is inevitable. So get ready.
Get with it, I think is what he was saying.
Get with it.
We've covered many topics like we normally do in Common Stories. I think we started with the governor's speech. We moved to the National Geographic.
We came full circle, though.
And we've come all the way back. So you've been listening to Counter Stories. I'm Don Eubanks, assistant professor and cultural consultant.
Anthony Galloway, race equity advocate, Umoja Consulting.
Luz Maria Frias, president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
Guest tonight, Mary Ann Quiroz, cultural arts director, co-founder of Indigenous Roots.
And I'm Jonathan Blakely, program director here at NPR News.